executive chairman of a AI company that really isn't involved in media, but we developed some advertising for our company, video advertising, and came out spectacularly and so good, I thought, that it looked like something we had taken to a major ad agency creative shop and paid them a couple million dollars to develop it. And the CEO of our AI company decided, hey, let me take a shot at making a film. If I can develop a video at that quality in short form, maybe I can do it in long form. And nobody had really done that yet, of being able to create a high quality, full length, completely AI generated live action, meaning looking like it was real actors doing it, motion picture. And it turned out to be a beautiful, poetic, haunting, unbelievably powerful film. And Tribeca looked at it and said, wow, this is really something we want to put in the festival. It became the first full-length motion picture to be accepted by a major film festival.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Very excited to have my guest on, truly a legend in communication industry, the telecommunications industry, in media, digital media, Tom Rogers, a true pioneer, visionary. He was the first president of NBC Cable, founded CNBC, then established MSNBC after that, served as the founding president of CNBC, as a contributor at CNBC and MS Now, where we got to know each other on the Stephanie Ruhle Show as guests, and senior advisor to Versant, was the parent company of CNBC and MS Now, editor at large at Newsweek, and executive chairman of Fountain Zero, an AI motion picture company, production company that's doing this endlessly interesting and fascinating work. Tom, that is all the time we have for your credits. Thank you for being on the show. No, good to have you on the show.
Thank you for that introduction.
Absolutely.
Great to be here. You have much to your credit.
Ah, thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's been a, we're both sort of recovering lawyers, if you will, you know, got into this industry in different ways, but we had that common and we talked a lot about that. We had a lovely lunch recently. But to be on Stephanie's show with you was really great. I thought we had a great conversation, but I've followed you for a long time and people really should know, if they don't know, how the ripple effects of the work that you've done that have affected them and they don't. I mean, just by way of background, and we could start with, you know, when you were senior counsel to the House Telecommunications Subcommittee and were one of the key architects behind the 1984 Cable Communications Act. And you played a central role in that. And that was at a point when the industry was sort of needing regulation. Talk a little bit about where cable was, what it was then versus what it became, and the importance of that act, and sort of the stories that you told relate to me about just sort of the negotiations and how those went on.
Well, there's a long story there. The short version of it was in the early 80s when cable was just really getting off the ground. The cities loved holding up cable operators to pay for all kinds of municipal things, paving sidewalks, libraries, whatever, as a condition of getting their local franchise to wire the city and provide cable service to residents.
And we
worked with the cable industry closely to make sure that the potential that we saw in cable to create competition and diversity of programming sources by allowing it to invest in programming content as opposed to being held up for another source of municipal revenue. And we created the first federal regulatory scheme that kind of put in place the guardrails so that there was some ability for revenue generation for municipalities, but for the most part, cable was able to develop. And from there, of course, 500 channels or more of cable television over the next couple of decades, developed as cable became the best media model known to man. So we accomplished what we needed to. It almost fell apart at the last minute on an issue related to equal employment opportunity, which we thought in the context of diversifying programming sources, workplace in the media world should be diversified also. But conservative Republicans had very different views of that. And the bill almost went down. I was able to forge a midnight compromise right before Congress was about to go out with the Senate Judiciary Committee chief of staff that enabled the bill to be taken up on the floor of the House and then the floor of the Senate within hours of Congress adjourning, and we were able to send the bill to President Reagan for signature. But cable almost went down if that last minute compromise had not happened.
Talk a little bit more about the compromise. I love that sort of backroom politics. Like, what did you have to give up? What did they have to give up? Like, how did you meet in the middle on that?
Well, it was over 40 years ago, but racial preferences were as big an issue among Senate Republicans then as it is now. And they were reading the language as creating hiring quotas. We were reading the language as enabling affirmative action for an important new player in the media industry to make sure that underrepresented voices were going to be part of the employment picture. And we came to a compromise which basically laid the groundwork for the industry to reach out for that kind of hiring and making it very clear the intention was not quotas. And as it turned out, the cable industry always had a very strong affirmative action hiring practice that was a very important element of how the industry developed.
Well, you know, it's because what was happening with cable is it was moving from a system for like retransmitting broadcast stations to being like a major independent television industry, like capable of supporting new networks and programming and creating a huge new sector of the economy. Did you see that on the horizon for this? And how did it sort of come to be that it sort of went from that patchwork kind of framework to this behemoth that it became?
Well, patchwork is a good word because we did have a patchwork of local and state regulation, which was clearly inhibiting the growth. And we saw the potential because Ted Turner had already started CNN and some of the other older cable channels had begun. And we could see the potential that if more of the cable operators' revenue could be poured back into programming, that we could really proliferate and expand the number of programming sources there were, not the least of which was news. Remember, news at the time, other than Turner just having begun CNN, was basically a function of three broadcast television networks and their news divisions, which basically had outlets of a half hour of evening news and a few hours of morning news. And we thought news could be expanded dramatically. And with that, the number of points of view that people were exposed to increased dramatically.
So I think you were telling me at lunch, like sort of the broadcast networks, were they not taking cable seriously and that you were trying to warn the networks that cable was coming and this was something that they should be on board with? And then there was also something about Amazon and Netflix and wanting the cable people to sort of bring them into the fold, but they kind of poo-pooed it.
Amazon and Netflix were many, many, many years later.
Right.
The cable side of the equation was certainly very political at the time, with broadcasters very much not wanting cable to expand and become more prominent. And within the company I operated, having been hired as the first president of NBC Cable, there was a lot of internal tension with broadcasters not understanding why GE owned NBC at the time. Why was it tolerating the funding of losses on cable, where broadcast, which was in the heyday of its power as a programming medium, why was GE not investing all that money into movies of the week and more broadcast programming instead of trying to grow small cable channels? And it took a while to convert broadcasters to the understanding that cable was going to become a more and more powerful medium, and the fact that it didn't just rely on advertising, but had this other very important source of revenue, which was payments from cable operators in the form of subscription fees that enabled these new cable channels to have two major sources of revenue, and with that to reinvest in their programming and grow in prominence. But ultimately, all the broadcast networks became the biggest cable program owners as well.
Yeah, but it took a lot of convincing from you and others like you, right? I mean, they were just slow to the party. And then, like you, as we talked about, and you just mentioned, so Amazon, if jump to Amazon and Netflix for a minute, and how they, cable didn't sort of really want them at the party as well. So cable kind of did to Amazon and Netflix, if I'm understanding this right, sort of what broadcast was doing to cable. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's pretty close. As streaming developed, I was the CEO of TiVo, and we were the only ones at the time that had an ability to not only deliver linear channels that allowed people to record them and then watch them when they wanted to, really beginning broad-based on-demand viewing, which has become accepted norm now with streaming, but that we were the first to enable Netflix and Amazon to stream to the television set and YouTube as well. And we showed how all traditional broadcast and cable channels and these new streaming services could be integrated into one consumer interface, and you could switch between them and easily manipulate the screen to have them all in one place in one bundle. And since we viewed ourselves as very friendly at TiVo to the cable industry, we were evangelizing, hey, cable operators, here's a way to really make sure that this new form of programming, streaming, doesn't develop outside of your bundle, but instead develop as part of your bundle. And we showed them how universal search, so you could search across cable channels and the broadcast channels they were delivering at the same time, Netflix and Amazon, and how all that could be a single consumer experience that they could own and control and grow with. Then CEO of Time Warner, Jeff Bukas, who was a friend and somebody who I admired and many things he did, unfortunately, how he characterized the streamers was the way the industry saw them. He said, you know, why should we help the Albanian army do anything? These guys are fledgling nothings. And of course, that turned out to be a very, very wrong judgment. And despite the fact that we evangelized throughout the cable industry that they should take this and bring them inside the fold. And we were working with Reed Hastings and Netflix at the time, and they would have loved that boost from the cable industry. Mm. Unfortunately, the cable industry totally misread the development of the marketplace, and cord cutting is what followed, and they ended up with a highly diminished video service relative to what they had.
Yeah, well, they should have listened to Tom, right? I mean, that's, you know, it's sort of like, how do you, you know, when you're at the epicenter of writing the Cable Communications Act and sort of, and president of NBC Cable, how do you at least not take that conversation seriously is beyond me. But when you were president of NBC Cable, was the creation of CNBC a tough sell for Jack Welch and your bosses? And also, you know, you've been credited with, like, you've had this ability to recognize early on that cable could support, like, highly specialized networks. So what did you see, like, in the economics, audience viewing habits that told you that there could be this sort of niche networks, these niche networks, if you will, and it would be supported, you know, by a vast audience? What was there for you?
Well, it was the power of niche and how niche, under this new model of both advertising and cable subscription fees, could create very powerful economics, even for services that didn't drive a lot of viewership in the scheme of what broadcast networks were traditionally delivering. I remember sitting down with Brandon Tartikoff, who was the ultimate head of broadcast entertainment division. He was president of NBC Entertainment at must-see TV Thursdays, and was all about how do you drive mass programming. And I remember sitting down with him and saying, look, Brandon, the cable model is very different. Our goal at CNBC is to make sure that 99.7% of the television audience is never watching CNBC at any given time. And he thought that was an absurd statement. And I said, but you got to understand, Brandon, with a 0.3% rating, what we will be able to do in terms of developing a niche audience, because the value of that audience to certain advertisers, obviously financial services advertisers and people who want to reach high net worth individuals, and the power of the fees that cable operators will pay to have a service that attracts people to that type of content, is going to create economics that are very enviable over time. That was a very hard thing for people who grew up thinking that the only way television could be profitable was to aggregate the biggest possible audience in the television space at any given time.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, when you consider, I had this view of it all was that, you know, obviously just as a consumer, you know, okay, it's cable. This is an interesting new thing. I liked the, oh my God, there's just a sports network now. I don't just have to watch my sports at 6 and 11 o'clock and get, you know, and it was an eye opener in terms of a consumer that something like this could even exist. And yet, you know, again, you're getting pushback sort of at the higher levels within your company. But then when you created CNBC in 89, and then what, 7 years later, MSNBC, which is now MS Now, like, what was that experience like creating CNBC? Were there stumbling blocks that you did not anticipate? Obviously, doing something that complicated is going to be, in actuality, harder than you planned.
Well, and to truth be told, we didn't start out to create CNBC. When I got to NBC in 1987, the stock market crashed shortly thereafter, and Black Monday, which was still the worst one-day drop in the stock market, down 22%. And Ted Turner, actually shortly thereafter, called me up. I knew him from Capitol Hill, from all the cable legislation. Ted was very active on the Hill, and he had gotten himself into some financial difficulty with buying MGM, the movie studio, and leveraging up his company heavily. And that brought in cable operators to his company, effectively having to bail him out. But they were the control owners of his company. And with the stock market crash and the financial pressures he was under, he called me up and said, you know, we could do something. And I looked at that as an opportunity to be accepted by the cable industry, because that was where the cable club was. And that if we were part owners of Turner Broadcasting, that we would be part of the club. And over the course of a few months, we put together a deal where NBC was going to own 25% of Turner. And our first step in terms of creating synergy was going to be to combine the foreign bureaus of NBC with CNN International. And we'd be off to the races with a combination. But GE, which had acquired NBC just before that, didn't really know the media industry. Jack Welch wanted to meet Ted Turner, and we put the together, and that meeting did not go well at all.
It was like two big egos clashing. What was that? How did that go?
Ted was trying to show he could be a subservient corporate citizen in an unusual way, and it did not go well. And Jack came out of the meeting and said, "We got to find our own path." But I knew, even though we had ambitions to start a news channel, that the cable industry was not going to distribute NBC as a news channel to compete with CNN now that they were owners in that company, and that we had to find an alternative path. And that's where Business News came in, and we were able to say, hey, you have a crappy little cable channel called Financial News Network. We can do a whole lot better than that, and we can revolutionize business news and the way it's covered. And we set out to do that, and eventually drove FNN into bankruptcy, and we acquired them in bankruptcy. And with that, we created our unique position in the cable industry, and ultimately were able to revolutionize business news along the way.
Yeah. Do you want to tell people what Ted did in the meeting? We'll leave it alone. Okay.
I'll leave that off. I respect the hell out of him, and he recently passed, and we lost a great pioneer.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was it about in creating CNBC, establishing MSNBC, which is now MS Now? What do you think you understood about people's relationship with news, whether it's finance news or just across the board more general, that was changing that the traditional networks maybe didn't see yet? Because you seem to be this sort of visionary along the way. At every key moment, you seem to be ahead of the curve, including with AI, which we're going to talk about in your production company in a minute. But what did you see about that, the people's relationship with news, that told you you see something that the traditional networks don't?
Well, I have to hand it to Ted Turner first, that he showed that a 24-hour all-news service could be something that people cared about. When we couldn't do a general news channel at that point, which we were interested in because we had all this overhead at NBC News, and we only had a few hours a day that all that overhead was being utilized, and that being able to bring it into 24 hours of cable programming would have made very good use of that NBC infrastructure. But business news was clearly hugely important. You didn't have to look very far to see all the, from Forbes to Fortune to Business Week to Wall Street Journal to endless stock letters, and the number of people even then which were invested in the stock market, that there was massive interest in business news, but nobody was treating it as if it was game on every day in the stock market, that it was like a football game. And hey, the market was going to open, and there's stories before and stories going on while the game's playing out, and then a recap of what was happening. And that if you brought that to life in an interesting way, a whole new component could be brought to the business day. And you know, we had a lot of talent at NBC that understood production, and people who were brought in from various financial content players that gave us the credibility to do it. And we established it. And over time, it just improved in its performance year after year. And it's become just a key franchise in the business world. If there's a business story that's happening, CNBC is there.
Yeah. On the news side, the MS now was MSNBC side. Did you realize at the time that you weren't just creating like news networks, you were changing people's relationship with news? Like, it's almost like it's addicting, you know, for me and a lot of people now, it's like you're constantly checking, refreshing. Did you have a sense that that was what the impact would be on people, or that's what people wanted, or was that just sort of a natural byproduct of it?
Well, it was clear that there was room for competition in the news marketplace on television. And that was right. The whole policy goal of the Cable Communications Act in 84, which was, we need to create more competition. We need to create more diversity among the sources of news content. And it was, you know, being able to then implement that policy and the competition that it brought about was clearly part of that. But the way we got into news, general news, was a little different. What happened was that the FCC changed the rules on cable operators just being able to take broadcast networks and their stations and retransmit them without having to pay the broadcasters and stations for that. So when they changed the rules and said, okay, now it's going to be different. Broadcast stations have the right to negotiate with cable operators for whether they'll be carried or not. And if they are going to be carried, then stations can ask for compensation and to be paid. And so all of a sudden, there was this huge negotiation in the media industry between networks and stations and cable operators, on the other hand, for what were cable operators going to pay. And it got very tense because the last thing in the world that cable operators wanted to do is to pay for all the stations they had been retransmitting for free.
Right. And
I came up with another thought. We had now been accepted in the cable industry with CNBC. And I went to the cable operators and said, hey, look, we're not going to make you pay just to carry our existing content. Instead, how about we're going to create a channel now? We're not going to call it general news like CNN. We're going to call it America's Talking. And it's going to be about the news, but it's going to be a talk channel about the news. And you're going to pay us for that, this new content we're bringing to you. But embedded in that price will be giving us money essentially for all the value we give you by you getting to carry football and the Olympics and all the other high value programming that you got for NBC all these years for free. And they liked that because they weren't sitting there doing what CBS asked them to do, which was just pay us for what you've already been carrying. We were creating a way for them to pay for something new that was going to be cable exclusive, and something they could put a cable moniker on. I wrote the description of the channel. So it gave us room to ultimately translate that into MS Now. But the basic content license we established was called America's Talking. And America's Talking lasted in that form for a few years, and ultimately became the place what we substituted and became MSNBC. And it became MSNBC after we realized that it was much more important to get NBC News and the NBC News content and infrastructure and personalities into this channel. But that was going to cost a lot more money than what we were doing with America's Talking. And we picked up that Microsoft was talking to CNN at the time. And the last thing we wanted was Microsoft, the number two company in the world to GE, then talking to CNN. And we thought, maybe we could pull Microsoft into us if we talk to them about launching a new channel. And so Andy Lack, the president of NBC News, and I pitched Bill Gates on a joint venture of Microsoft and NBC to create not only a new news channel, but to create a companion internet service. And they would run the news internet service. We would run the cable channel. And they bought that.
Amazing.
They bought that notion. Established.
That's amazing. So the way you beat out CNN on that was sort of what were the key components of that that convinced them to come to your side of the table? Was it the idea of them controlling a sort of a web-based service and you control the cable side of it? Like how did you sort of win the day over CNN?
They were just getting their feet wet into the media world. And they had missed the beginning of the internet, and they were looking to catch up and do something innovative in internet media. And we committed that this joint venture would have access to all of NBC News and CNBC and the archives going back to 1947 of NBC News. We pitched Gates on how all of that could be personalized through the internet and all. And he very much bought that, although we were looking at that as a future notion down the road. I think at the time he thought all that could be developed immediately.
Right away.
which they got wrong. Yeah. And we thought GE was not all that interested in funding more losses in the cable world. And Jack Welch loved the idea of Microsoft's money coming into this to fund the development of this new channel. And so the combination of all that made for a deal.
So in doing all of this, going back to being a young lawyer with on the Hill, and you're doing these amazing deals, and you're not just, listen, I worked in merger and acquisition as a lawyer and a banker, and just to put two existing entities together that exist, it's complicated, let alone create an industry, then create the companies within the industry. Were there ever nights you go home to your wife and go like, what am I doing? Banging your head against the wall and just saying, I'm going to just go open up a practice of my own. Like, with any stories that come to mind where you're like, this is crazy. How am I going to pull this off? You can't believe what happened to me today, dear. Like I can imagine it. There must have been some of those moments.
Well, there were a lot of moments when we didn't think we could pull this off and the cable industry might quash us and decide that we were the enemy and not to be do deals with. And but I never looked back and said, no, I prefer to be practicing law. I considered myself very lucky to, I had worked as a lawyer for 2 years on Wall Street before going to Capitol Hill. And I considered myself very lucky to have escaped the law firm and had the opportunity to work on Capitol Hill, and even luckier to escape Washington law firm trade association life to be able to work in the media industry and implement in practice some of the policies that we had developed legislatively. So I never looked back at that.
Yeah. So when you, just one last thing on the creation of these networks, like when you're doing this, how much of your audience and what you learn about them do you discover after the fact, right? You can anticipate and strategize when you're creating an MSNBC or a CNBC, what your audience is going to look like, want, what the demo is going to be. How much of that do you discover after the fact, or is it just ever evolving? Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, you're always looking at what works with audiences, what doesn't. When we launched CNBC, most people thought CNBC stood for cable NBC. It actually stood for consumer news and consumer news and business channel. And the consumer news part of it, we put some emphasis on in the beginning, and we had beauty products for women being showcased at some points during the day. And the hardcore investors who were looking at stock tickers all day threw up all over that kind of content. And we had to quickly...
Wait, go back. You mean like you had like a little infomercial in the middle of the day?
Not infomercials, but the coverage during the day included consumer products and consumer tips that wasn't really business or finance, and
a hard-bitten trader on Wall Street didn't want to hear about skincare products.
We and more importantly, cable operators got letters that were like, "What the hell?" So we course corrected on that very quickly. One of the difficult things about measurement, and it's only gotten worse, is Nielsen was always terrible at really getting small audience measurement well and really understanding how to go deep into tiny segments of audience and what was working and what was not. So
explain that a little bit for our viewers and listeners, meaning Nielsen is good.
Nielsen had a very small sample of homes at the time. I think it was 20,000. They've increased it to about 40,000 homes. But when you're talking about millions of homes and you're talking about, what were dozens ending up with hundreds of channels, each taking small slices of audience. You know, one Nielsen people meter in a home can throw off ratings dramatically. And so billions of dollars are traded in the advertising marketplace of television off of what is incredibly prehistoric measurement metrics that, haven't gotten a whole lot better over the years, and continues to be a huge issue as slices of audiences have only gotten smaller and options and the amount of content has only proliferated.
Yeah. So how I want to talk about your AI work in a minute, but so how have you done this in your career, right? You lived through broadcast television, the epicenter for the rise of cable, the internet, streaming, now AI. You have this sort of ability to, for lack of a better term, see what's on the horizon before other people. You seem to be at the right spot. I don't know. Do you just have a little angel that whispers in your ear? Like, you just seem to be at the right spot in the right moment. Or do you know somebody on the inside and you're paying them like $100 on the side in a back alley or something like that? How have you been able to be there on all of those critical moments?
Well,
and don't be modest, Tom, come on.
I've been lucky to work in the transition points of the media industry, from the regulatory transition, and then the industry transitions from there. And it wasn't as if cable was an absolute new discovery. It was working at a company where people weren't recognizing it yet, but I thought, the writing was already on the wall. It was a question of how do you galvanize a company to make a transition when it wasn't otherwise prepared to make it. I think that's been a problem with the media industry generally. Netflix and streaming was pretty obvious to me that it was going to create enormous libraries of content being at people's fingertips and giving them enormous options. And it wasn't that it was unclear that that was the case. It was just the traditional media companies were taking much longer than they should have to make the pivots that they needed to make to take advantage of those transitions. And I think, you know, never confuse being able to see the horizon with a short distance. The fact is, these things can be pretty far away to some, even though you can see them. And yeah. The question is, once you've identified them, what is your path to join them and be not miss what are, I think, fairly obvious evolutions. My view has always been that the trends are clear. The problem is incumbents move too slowly. And I've been involved with incumbent media companies my entire career, either running them or working in partnership with them. And they just move too slowly.
And I think that's because people are afraid of losing their job by taking risks, right? It's sort of, especially when you become secure and the larger you become, the more risk averse you become. You see it in the entertainment industry on the buyer side of content, right? Like, it's easier for someone to say, why did you buy that show, that sitcom that failed? Well, it was because it was like six others that have been successful, and they'd be okay versus, okay, your job's safe versus, why did you buy that sitcom that no one else is even putting on and it failed? You took too much of a risk. And so that, I think, is always, for me personally, and I think a lot of people, been sort of some of the knocks on the entertainment industry, is the lack of willingness to take creative risk, because people need to feed their family and people.
Yeah.
And I think that's the case with executives. I saw it when I was on Wall Street. Once you get big and once you get safe, you get comfortable in a certain suit of clothes, you want to stay in those suit of clothes.
Yep. I'd also say other parts of the media industry have reacted very differently to change. The music industry got totally run over by digital and the ability to get music online and on your phone. And it totally disrupted the industry. But what emerged from that was Spotify and the other music services, where you can get every piece of music ever made in the history of mankind, all right, under one roof for one price, in your pocket to take with you anywhere, to have and personalize your playlist in any way you want. Video did not do that. It remained balkanized. The companies made transitions to digital, but they didn't ever get run over the way music did, and therefore didn't restructure and reorganize in a way that was as consumer friendly as music has. And so you have multiple services still, and you need to subscribe to each of them. And there's no one interface that allows you to create your one way of seeing what's on at any given time all at once. It's still a very balkanized consumer experience. And with that, there's a lot of challenge less to making the ultimate consumer experience, but what also leaves the existing players far more vulnerable to the next wave. Hmm.
The AI component of this and your company Fount Zero, you've created a fabulous film that's been accepted into festivals now, completely AI generated, called Dreams of Violets. And talk about what you see happening with AI in general and in this industry. Is it the sort of is it the ogre in the room that everybody's saying? Are you worried about it? Do you see it in a more positive light? Talk about the film and how that came about as well.
Well, that film came about because I'm executive chairman of a AI company that really isn't involved in media, but we developed some advertising for our company, video advertising, and came out spectacularly and so good. I thought that it looked like something we had taken to a major ad agency creative shop and paid them a couple million dollars to develop it. And with the with what came out of that, the CEO of our AI company decided, hey, let me take a shot at making a film. If I can develop a video at that quality in short form, maybe I can do it in long form. And nobody had really done that yet, of being able to create a high quality, full length, completely AI generated live action, meaning looking like it was real actors doing it, motion picture. The film he developed, he and his brother are refugees from Iran, were politically persecuted, and decided that they wanted to make a film about the January protests in Iran, where thousands of protesters were killed. And it turned out to be a beautiful, poetic, haunting, unbelievably powerful film. And Tribeca, even though we had missed the deadline for a couple months of entry for Tribeca, they looked at it and said, wow, this is really something we want to put in the festival. It became the first full-length motion picture to be accepted by a major film festival. Our next film, which is riding the wave of Chris Nolan's big release, The Odyssey, is called Odysseus: The Fall, which is another take on Odysseus and his journey. And while our first film was kind of a independent film, art house type, this is very much intended to show what a big budget Hollywood blockbuster type of approach might look like with AI tools that can be. The first film was done for $2,000. This film was done for mid five figures, meaning about 1/5,000th the cost of Chris Nolan's film. Obviously, his film is getting rave reviews, and we have no expectation people are going to think our film is necessarily of that at that level. But it is an interesting reference point, with one being the highest film, the highest quality film of traditional human production, and one being the highest quality today of AI machine production, both emanating from human creativity, but both produced with very, very, very different cost structures, give people an opportunity to compare the two and hopefully give people a sense of what AI quality can look like. It is by no means all slop. Even though there's plenty of slop out there, we can create with our proprietary software what we think are the highest end motion pictures.
And the actors in both of these films, you're not using likenesses of established actors or whatever. Is that correct? Talk about who we're seeing on camera.
Well, theirs is as star-studded a film as you can get, and ours is not using any known actors. We do have some real people's images in there. For instance, I am in the film as one of the characters, and two co-founders of Fountain Zero, our studio, Ash, the film creator, his brother, Puya, who is a key AI infrastructure genius, are both characters in the film, and a number of other people that were involved with us are characters in the film. But over time, we certainly hope to license the images of influencers who we think can be key promoters and marketers of film, will be known, recognized personalities. And over time, I think actors will want to be involved as well to license their images. Obviously, that's very controversial in Hollywood.
Yeah, and AI is being used to write the films as well, I would imagine. I mean, with some human input, obviously.
The writing, the creativity is really coming from, in this case, one person. I mean, both films, which is just unbelievable to me, were done by one person.
Yeah, that's creating that blows me away.
Unbelievable yeah. films, part-time, as a full-time job as a CEO of an AI company, and did this as a part-time over a few months for, you know, close to zero cost. Yeah. Is where Fountain Zero, the name, comes from. And the idea, the creativity, the scripting, it's not as formal structure, a script as you would find in a Hollywood context. Some of it develops as you go, but all that is human creativity. It's everything else that goes into the production of a film where AI is there. And it's not that revolutionary when you think about it. We've had computer graphics in film for a long time. It's just that CGI is very expensive compared to using AI. And you can't just sit down with an AI model and prompt it and out comes a motion picture. There's obviously very sophisticated secret sauce, proprietary software that's built on top. In this case, a Chinese model called Kling that is responsible for being able to get something that looks identical to a human production. But it's really just amazing if that's what's possible today. Where we think this can go in developing great tools in the hands of filmmakers who can't get budgets to do anything close to what Nolan was able to get budgets for. Independent filmmakers who have smaller ideas for film that still cost several million dollars and just can't.
There's a lot of brilliant talent out there that has trouble seeing the light of day because of the finances.
Any great writer like you knows that.
Where can people see the film that's out now and the one that's coming out to the
Right now the way to see Dreams of Violets is to go to fountainzero.com, the number zero. Fountainzero.com, and the film can be rented for viewing there. And the trailer for Odysseus the Fall is there. And Odysseus will be first released there when we have it come mid-August.
Great. So can I have you for two more minutes very quickly? I want to get your thoughts on sort of the political landscape. You also are editor-at-large at Newsweek. You have a piece out, If Save America Dies, How Could Trump Still Kill Elections? I think it's a really important piece that people should read. It is my biggest concern of what's going on in the political landscape right now. And there's an interesting quote in there. You say, on the other hand, he, Trump, may well find alternative means to undermine election results in a way that does not require congressional action through actions on the president's part, which he would claim are uniquely part of his executive authority. I think you're referring to PEDS, but explain that thought of yours a little bit to people and what we should be concerned about in the midterms and going beyond that.
Well, I'm not sure what I wrote would be considered very mainstream views until about 4 days after, no, I guess it was a couple of days after writing this column and discussing it on Morning Joe, Trump gave his primetime address, which made very, very clear that he is setting the groundwork for being able to disrupt. And if he loses, totally undermining the.
Let me mention to people, what you're referring to is this address that was done recently where he laid out a whole bunch of reasons why he won the 2020 election and why it was rigged and what needs to be fixed. So, but yeah, continue. I just wanted to make sure people were following that.
I mean, it was a presidential address rant about how our election have not been protected. They have been undermined by foreign actors that, illegal immigrants have been voting and setting the stage to take action for 2026, where he's now begun to talk about a communist threat that's more severe than World War One or World War Two or Pearl Harbor or 9/11, that it's the biggest crisis we've ever faced. And the Social Democrats are communists trying to infiltrate the country and creating what is obvious groundwork to say that there's a election manipulation and the federal government needs to step in, declare an emergency, and probably attempt to take control of election machines to say that the elections cannot be certified. Members of Congress who were elected cannot be seated.
The bottom line there is that he realized last time, having been thwarted by Congress in 2020 in his attempt to overturn the election, thanks to Mike Pence, and having been thwarted by the courts in many attempts to try to overturn various state elections, that if he's going to be successful this time, he's going to have to avoid the Congress and courts. And that gets really, really scary. There, and what you refer to as PEDS, I write about as little known prepared documents that every president has had ready to go since the Eisenhower administration, but have never been used. PEDS stands for Presidential Emergency Action Documents, and they're intended to be immediately signed if some true emergency, like a nuclear attack, and you have the social fabric of the country falling apart, and extraordinary actions need to be taken that involve suspending habeas corpus and detaining people without trial and seizing property and all kinds of actions that otherwise would be unlawful and the courts would never stand for. And you've heard Trump talk about, well, I have great emergency powers people don't even know about, and hard to believe he wouldn't be referring to these. And the idea that he could claim that the elections need to be investigated and can't be certified, and that creates massive street protests, and he brings out National Guard or other armed forces or maybe ICE to deal with quelling that, and that creates further violence, which gives him the pretense to declare an emergency and issue these documents, which in his mind might give him the ability to avoid court review of something going on here. It just looks like he's trying to set the stage and create a pretense for something really, really bad. And the only way to protect against that is to get people knowledgeable about it, and not only to have Democrats who are now widely talking about it, which wasn't the case a week ago before his speech, but begin to get local Republican officials all the way up to Republicans in Congress and Senate who have been pretty spineless when it comes to standing up to Trump, declaring beforehand that they are not going to be party to delegitimizing elections, nor are they going to be party to trying to call into question the integrity of the elections. And it's a really serious issue that we all have to take very, very seriously.
Absolutely. Just to button up that as well, you mentioned in the article that it's expending a lot of political capital on this front. But my concern is he seems to have an endless supply of political capital. What I didn't see coming is in his second term, I thought, okay, well, people will start to pull away from him because it's the second term and he's done. But that's not happening. It's not happening enough for me or fast enough for me. And so that's a big concern of mine, is he just seems to be Teflon when it comes to all of this and has this political capital and then some. And that can go a long way in a bad way for the rest of the country.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I've been amazed that when he was inaugurated, his approval rating was a little underwater. It was 47%.
Right.
And until the last few days, really, when you look at the Real Clear Politics average approval rating of the various polls, it was only down to about 40%, meaning he only lost 7% approval, with everything that this administration has done that people don't approve of. And yet they put it all together and say, well, relative to the alternative, I still give them my overall approval. That is really scary relative to what we just talked about, because it's going to take Republican officials believing that their own political bases are not going to be supporting Trump when it comes to trying to overturn the elections. And that is an unknown variable right now.
Yeah, I don't know what shakes people's confidence in the guy. I mean, we talked about this when we were on Stephanie's show about, you know, and it's obvious, and the story blew up from there about, the amount of money that he and his family are making and the crypto deals, et cetera. But you said talk to the average person about it, their attitude is like, yeah, you know, that's what politicians do. They've been doing it since, you know, time immemorial. My local mayor would take kickbacks to get roads paved. What's the big deal? And then they move on. So I don't know what it has to be. I guess billions of dollars in crypto profits, et cetera, real estate deals, that doesn't do it. January 20th doesn't do it. January 6th doesn't do it. So, you know, look, I'm hoping something finally kind of light bulb goes on for these people. But I just wanted to say it's been great to have you on. This someone that I really admired and really happy that people can get to know more about you through my show. You've done some amazing things.
I just want to apologize because you are known as a great comic and a great comedy writer. And this has been a great discussion, but there was not one thing funny that I said, particularly the last part. And I didn't bring out any of your comedic instincts. So I apologize to your listeners for a very serious discussion.
I wanted it to be serious unless you were bored with it. I loved it. It's really on me to be the comedian, but I try to find it where it's got to be. And we didn't need to have it. I think it's just perfect the way it was, you know. We can always do it again and have some laughs, but I loved doing this and I thought it was exactly what we wanted people to get to know and hear. So, thank you. And, Fountain Zero, Dreams of Violence is the film. People can go online and download that, and, better have you come back on and we'll talk some other politics and other good stuff that you're doing down the road.
Look forward to it. Thanks for having me, Paul.